Welcome to the Only One Shot Studios, located in the great state of Mississippi, and that was our dear friend Steve Azar. And that song, The Coach, was from his album, Indianola. You can check out Steve Azar on steveazar.com. He's got some new music out. Check him out. He's one of those Mississippians. We love listening to his music. Good old guy from the Mississippi Delta. I'm Jim Gallagher, Jr. I'm your host. I played on the PGA Tour from 1984-2000. I was a member of the Ryder Cup, winning Ryder Cup, and the winning President's Cup. Played the PGA Tour Champions, and after all those years, spent some time at home there, didn't play a whole lot of golf, lost a little bit of that competitive edge, and decided to be a golf analyst for the Golf Channel, and I've enjoyed that the last 4 years. And you can find me on Instagram, Gallagher Jr., and at Twitter, Gallagher Jr. GC. Today we're going to talk, we're going to continue talking our first two podcasts, but it's about the book Only One Shot. It was written by Vijay Trolio. He's the teaching professional at the Old Waverly Golf Club in West Point, Mississippi. He's a top 100 teacher. Had a very good professional career and wanted to get into the teaching side. He's been my co-host, but Vijay, you're going to become the host today, and I'm just going to sit back and enjoy the ride. So well, take her away, Vijay.
Yeah, what we're going to try to do here is package what we talked about in the first podcast as far as, even though it was questions about my junior golf career and college careers, like, okay, we have a junior golfer, college golfer, right? And then we're going to try to package this idea that we talked about in the second podcast, which is boredom, proximity, and routine. Now, one thing that you talked about in the second podcast was you have to explain this world of everybody gets a trophy.
Yeah, our society's gotten a little soft. Now, I am 58 years old, and my dad was my sole instructor, and he grew up in Western Pennsylvania. He's a Steelers fan, so obviously he grew up painting railroad cars, so he grew up tough. Your dad, tough guy as well, and we grew up. That's nothing wrong with that. They were hard workers, and they instilled those things in us, and it doesn't make us bad. We're still soft-hearted now. We have kids, but it was part of my personality. It was part of that drive, and I think, you know, I always wanted to be driven. You know, I wanted to be the best. I wanted to win as many trophies as I could. I mean, I didn't get handed the trophy, and I think, you know, we sometimes, as parents, we want to feel like we're doing the best thing for them, and we're almost crippling and handicapping our kids by, hey, feel good. Everybody gets a trophy. You did great. There's a fine line. We talked about a reward and being positive and constructive,
yeah,
in that everybody gets a trophy.
Yes.
And you mentioned that in the book, and you've got a pretty good angle on this, a little better than mine, because I'm a true believer. You know, with my kids, I said, hey, the adult, the person in charge is always right, and you're wrong until you prove me otherwise,
So in podcast two, we talk about this idea of, okay, your kid's going to get bored. Mm-hmm. Whatever they're closest to, that's probably what they're going to go to. Now, when they go to that, then here comes the set of habits, right? So cue, routine, reward. Now, when they go to that, right, whatever that challenge is, whatever they're trying to do, it could be a 3-foot putt, or it could be a 300-yard drive. It could be a 7,500-yard golf course, and they're an 8 handicapper. Or it could be a 6,300-yard golf course and they hit it 300 yards, right? We're not in control of the golf course setup.
Right.
Now, what we are in control of is how desirably difficult it is. So when we're setting the stage for our junior golfer at their proximity, at their golf course, to begin to play golf, we talked in podcast one about making sure that the driver carried about 70% of the total length of the golf course. That is to make the golf course desirably difficult.
Mm-hmm.
If the golf course is overly difficult, there's very little reward there.
Right.
So for our listeners, what I'd like to ask you is give me a golf tournament where the golf course was extremely difficult and you were hitting the golf ball extremely poor.
That would be the U.S. Open Pebble Beach, the year Tom Kite won. It was blowing about 40. It was difficult for everybody. And now, granted, I was 3 shots out going the final day. So it wasn't like I was coming in there playing poorly. But that day, I'd lost my mind, my game, and the belief in my game. And it was a struggle.
You mean the final round?
The final round, yeah. Excuse me. Well, I'd lost my mind way before that, but that's for another podcast. But I did. I got up there in the driving range, and it was really weird. And it was, you know, normal day, warming up, and all of a sudden, as I'm walking off and I didn't like to play in the wind.
I grew up in Indiana. Not like the wind.
Well, if it blew really hard, you got in the basement because that was a tornado coming in. You know, because that's what you had to do, but. I mean, I fought the wind as a player. I don't remember. As a kid, I probably didn't because I just went out and played. I think it became
expectations were different back then.
Yeah, and yeah. I think it was more. And I think it was blowing 40 that day at Pebble Beach, and the greens were concrete. They couldn't even. My father-in-law Ed Meeks was telling me that the guy that was changing the holes on the putting green couldn't even change the cups on the putting green. It was that hard. And that's what the U.S. Open is. It's a mental challenge. I struggled in the U.S. Open, you know, because I would let it get to me, honestly. If I'd known, you know, back then what I know now, I'd have been a little bit better, probably a little bit more patient with it. And I think that was difficult for me as I did. I just struggled. I mean, I like a challenge. I love to play a hard golf course. Now, don't get me wrong. I mean, my goal as a kid when I was a junior player is to shoot the lowest score I could possibly shoot. That's what I try to do constantly. You mentioned, I mean, I would do drills until, I mean, past dark that I had to, in a quadrant, I had to make 10 3-footers in a row from 4 different sides of the cup. Those are things I did. That's, I fought we didn't have a driving range, so I didn't practice much. But those are the little drills, the little challenges that I did.
And they were desirably difficult for you.
Well, yeah.
But if the USGA would have set that drill up for you.
Well, they'd have 4% slope and it'd have been something blocking the hole. In my mind, I mean, I'm not trying to bash them.
Sure.
But it was difficult.
You had a difficult time playing the USGA event at Pebble Beach because the golf course that they set up, you viewed as being undesirably difficult.
It was undesirable, I can tell you that. And it was. And it was, but someone was going to win. And that's the thing.
And the winner did not view it that way.
Oh, no. And that's why he won. I played with Jeff Sluman in the same group, same tee time, and he finished one shot back. And I shot, barely broke 90. So, I mean, I let it get to me. I mean, and it did a lot to me.
Now, let's go to the other end of that. Name a golf tournament that you played in where the golf course was playing so easy and the field was so weak and you were hitting it so well that you basically got bored.
I would say a lot of times it would be the Vegas tournament or sometimes even the Hope early in the year. I wasn't bored because I hadn't played a lot in the offseason. I'd say it's the Vegas tournament. I mean, people would shoot low. You're out there with the three guys. They might have been up all night in the casino. I knew you had to go low. I was basically bored to death, but I was just out there playing golf. And golf was easy. I mean, it was really easy to go through all those things. And I think you can fall into a bad habit there, too.
So there wasn't, in that situation, there wasn't, contrasting it to the Open at Pebble, the golf course was very easy.
Oh, yeah. If you didn't shoot 67 or 8.
The wind was not blowing.
Not at all.
And you were playing with pro-am partners rather than the best players in the world.
I wasn't challenged. Okay. I wasn't challenged, if that's the point I think you're trying to get now, to. I still played okay, but I wasn't. I needed to be challenged. I think when we get back to the mental challenge, that was my fault. I mean, the tougher the golf course, the better I played. I could shoot low scores, but I tended to play tougher golf courses that I deemed fair. In my mind, I deemed U.S. Opens unfair.
Yeah.
Now that goes back to a long history that I'm not even going to get into.
That deeming of how you define what is desirably difficult, that deeming comes from you when you're 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15. Mm-hmm. There's a whole thing. Senior's a big part of that. Ed Meeks is a big part of that. Sissy's a big part of that. You're a big part of that. Your college golf coach is a big part of that. The people you're hanging around on the PGA Tour are a big part of that. So, third, for our listeners, name a situation that was on the line. So when I refer to on the line, it was very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
You were playing very well. Maybe the conditions of the golf course or the gallery or the wind, it's all the same thing, right? External conditions were just right there on the border cusp of what you could handle. But you fell in love with that round of golf or that tournament.
1993. Match at the Ryder Cup with Seve Ballesteros. And I'll tell a little story that I think is kind of a cool story is I was a rookie on the team. I made it by points. We were going over and, I played my best with a little bit of a chip on my shoulder that I had. And I was constantly, and we may be getting off the rails, which I tend to do.
No,
I fought the fact that with my confidence. that was part of the problem in the U.S. Open. It was a confidence issue. It was a personal problem. It wasn't the USGA's problem. It was my problem. And I fought a little bit of my confidence. And my wife, Sissy, finally convinced me that I could actually play the game at a level that I did at that whole season in 93. But we got over there. I remember reading Golf World magazine. They did the evaluation of the preview of the players, and I was told that I had the heart of a lamb, and the Europeans would make chopped liver of me, and I shouldn't be on the team. Well, that's the chip I needed. And so instead of being nervous,
that's what made it desirably difficult for
exactly
you.
So I desired to whoop somebody, and it was going to be an amazingly difficult situation. But because of that, I had something to prove. And I went into that week really all through the matches that way. But when I got Saturday night, I was supposed to play Sam Torrence, who eventually had to withdraw, had a foot injury, and he had to withdraw. And back then, you had someone from each team put their name in an envelope. And Lanny Watkins, who was a pick, you know, Lanny Watkins is Lanny Watkins, put his name in our envelope in case this situation would happen. Sam had the WD. Instead of me having to forfeit or only getting a half a point, the name in the envelope was Lanny, so he got the half a point, which in turn switched me to play Seve. And I didn't find out till that morning, a few hours before I teed off, and I kept telling the Kites, Tom and Christy, we went to the morning service, and I was like, hey, I hope I'll play Seve. You know, I was walking around like I was some Billy, like the defensive back you see in football, say, bring it on. Well, about an hour later, I got my wish. And so you got to be careful sometimes what you pray for. You got to be a little more specific. But I wanted to. I wanted to play Seve because I had nothing to prove. To anybody, really, no one believed I was going to win. I had something to prove, I guess, in my mind. But
ultimately, you playing Seve was desirably difficult.
You think? I mean, he was only the best in the Ryder Cup and the toughest competitor you could play. And he was still playing well. I mean, I know it was 93. 95, he still made the Ryder Cup team. So he wasn't maybe at the top of his game, but he was still Seve Ballesteros. And I'll never forget, we got to the first tee, and I hit balls, and it was a normal warm-up. And I was a little more anxious. But it was fine. And we were down. We needed some points. And I knew my match was going to be big. And Lanny had pulled his name in the envelope. I mean, there was that pressure. But I wanted it. Somewhere deep inside, I wanted to prove to the world that, and probably, I guess, a little bit myself, that I could play at this level. And what did I have to lose? No one expected me to win. But I walked off, hit my tee shot. I mean, I couldn't get my ball on the tee. I was so nervous. Got my tee shot down there, and he hit it. And I remember Bernard Gallagher, who was there, captain, he turned around to Seve. He says, Seve, you'll beat him 7-5. Well, I just got enough redneck in me, and I turned around and I looked at Lanny, and Tom Watson was our captain. I said, it'll be the other way around, boys. He's getting his butt whooped today. And I mean, you know, that wasn't cocky, but I guess it was, but it was desirable. It was a tough situation.
I wanted it.
Now I really wanted it.
So you felt completely different in that event than you did in Vegas walking around with Pro-Am guys.
Watching the birds fly around, yeah.
Than you did at the U.S. Open at Pebble when Tom Kite won.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Completely different feeling. And I'll get to that point. I know you got a real true point to make, but as the round kept going on and I was ahead, I actually had given Seve a putt from about 3 feet, and I had about a 4.5-footer to win the hole. I mean, it was kind of a stupid move, but I was that confident in myself. And I said, that's good. And he looked at me like I had two heads. But I was putting the gauntlet down. I was going to prove to him I wasn't intimidated by him. And I don't know why that happened and what came over me. I've lost my mind once again. And, you know, I'm up at the turn, and I could hear the fans screaming, Seve, Seve. And so I start waving my arms like the defensive back, you know, bring it, bring it. And he tried to drive 10. Long story short, I ended up winning the match.
Yeah.
And it gave me confidence, and it took it skyrocket to a whole new level.
Right.
A, that I beat arguably one of the best Ryder Cup players
in that setting
in England. Now, this was not a home game. This is like being in Tiger Stadium in Baton Rouge at night, and I beat, you know, one of the best players in the game. Proved to them, in my little crazy mind, Golf World, who said I couldn't play, and myself, that I could play at that level. And the funniest thing, and I'll let you get going and really host, is Paul Azinger walked up to me after it was over. They were teasing me about being lamb chop, kind of the combination of what Golf World said. And he turned around, grabbed my face. He says, now you're killer lamb chop. So that's how that story came upon. And when I got home, Mary Langdon, who was my youngest or my oldest, and we were due with Thomas, she had a T-shirt on. It said, my daddy beat Seve. that was it. I'd hit the pinnacle, won the tour championship later that fall. So that was my great year. So the feelings I had there were so much different than Pebble Beach and so much different than at Vegas.
Right. And so for our listeners, they have to sort of go back to podcast one when you were asking me these questions about how I got into the game. Obviously, the game for me was desirably difficult. Tennis, I had it. I kind of understood what faces should do. Obviously, the U.S. Junior, me seeing Tiger Woods, the way he hit the ball, I was like, wow, that trying to beat him is not desirably difficult. When I played every event as a freshman at Southern Miss, the reason I went to the range is because I knew I couldn't complete this journey. I knew I needed something more to get better. So podcast two, when we're talking about boredom, proximity, and this whole idea of how a habit's created with a cue, routine, reward, then the reward and the routine there work together to create this habit. And they all work in conjunction with each other to build a mindset of a player. So when you look at somebody like some of the best players in the world, whatever sport they're, they're consistent. The best players in the world at whatever sport they do are very consistent. If they're very consistent, that means their mindset's consistent. That means that mentally, it never gets undesirably difficult in a performance standpoint. So their expectations and what they see are different. So as we package this, something I'd like to read from Only One Shot. This is quoted from the book. Senior, which is your dad, Senior was making golf a challenge for Jimmy and teaching him in a good way. Renowned psychologists Elizabeth and Robert Bjork have studied this process and refer to it as desirable difficulties. The Bjorks have managed experiments and studied two broad categories that tie learning and performance together. So this is not the book for a second, but what I'm going to say here is you learned something from Pebble.
Oh, yeah.
But your performance wasn't very good.
No, at least. Beat three people.
You learned something from the Ryder Cup, and your performance was great.
Right.
In both of those events, your performance was different. The key is, like, the learning part.
Right. And we always talk about you learn from your mistakes, but you also learn from your successes, too.
And we always talk about you learn more. As we package this together, you learn more from your mistakes, generally, than you do from your wins. The only thing about when your performance is great, your confidence goes up.
True.
So back to the book. They have identified that a lot of learning can take place without an increase in performance. They have also identified that significant learning does not always mark an increase in performance. The Bjorks refer to desirable difficulties as difficulties that trigger encoding and retrieval processes that support learning, comprehension, and remembering. So as we package this together, we have to understand that we have a junior golfer. We have to make it fun, desirable, enjoyable, right? When they get to the golf course, which is proximity, when we get them to the golf course, now you have this whole idea of creating a habit. So this cue, routine, reward. And you talked about this fine line that we talk about where, you know, if they top it, we probably shouldn't say good shot.
Probably not.
Right.
Yeah. You wouldn't like it.
No. That being said, we have to set up a situation where it's desirably difficult for them. So in podcast one, we talk about playing a hole where you can carry 70% of the distance of the hole in the tee shot. That sets up this idea of being desirably difficult. Now, when you go play golf with the end in mind, so when you think about your career on the PGA Tour, how desirably difficult is tour school?
Oh, toughest thing. I mean, you either make it or you don't.
Right.
And then you either have a job or you don't.
It's the most capitalistic of games golf is.
Yeah, and it's the most stressful, mind-losing situation.
How desirably difficult was it for you or I to be three shots back going into the last hole of a qualifier when we were sophomores in college?
I mean, yeah, it was pressure, but okay, I can survive this.
Right.
Yeah.
How desirably difficult is it for you to go play your very best golf, which has happened many times in your career, and get beat by 11?
Yeah, that happened a few times. Yeah, and it happened a lot to a lot of people when I, that's not why I quit playing, but from Tiger Woods. I mean, did it to him all the time. Jack Nicklaus would do it. Yeah, you feel like, I played my best, but I got just whooped.
Right.
Some days that happens.
So what you're looking for when it comes to your junior golfer is you're looking for a way for them to go perform in a situation that's difficult, but desirably difficult. So we don't need a super long golf course with super big rough, and we don't need to be out there for 4 or 5 hours when they're young kids. But we need a place where they can learn. But when I say learn, they need to be able to retrieve and encode that. So if they have a chance to make par on one and they scull it out of the bunker, they're going to get angry. I get it. Now, we shouldn't as parents.
Right.
But when they go get angry, let's let them walk across the green and chip it back up and see what happens. Mm-hmm. Because it needs to be a situation, we go to number two tee, that they can bang their tee ball down there, hit their 7-iron on the green, and have a chance for a putt for birdie. So if they 3-putt that, now they have to walk to the third tee and they're 3 over. But on the third tee, they're hitting another 7-iron, right, which they can carry to the green. And they have another opportunity for birdie. Well, let's say they've lost their mind from the sculled bunker shot in the 3-putt. So let's say now they 3-putt again and pick their ball up and walk to the fourth tee, completely have lost their mind.
I've been there, done that.
Yes, and everybody will. Mm-hmm. So at that moment, how do you make it desirably difficult for that young man or that young girl?
How do you?
Yes.
You answer that question because I haven't figured that one out. That's why you wrote the book, and that's why I quit playing.
You get them to
I never did figure that out.
You get them to reset.
Well, so how do you get them to reset?
Well, get them to look at the fourth hole, and at the fourth hole, you say, okay, listen, you know, what's the situation out in front of us right here? Right? It's always what's out in front of us. What's the situation out in front of us? It's a 180-yard par four. All right, well, great. Well, then grab your driver and let's bang it down there. Well, what about my three bogeys? Mm. Well, you're going to have to learn to get past that. Because if you've got to learn to encode this and put these things behind you.
I would say this for me, and what I would do if I got angry, and I did, it was over. Not always. Sometimes I carried it on. But when I kind of knew I was hitting it okay, and it was just a stupid mistake and hit a bad shot, I would get angry, obviously, and then I could kind of get rid of it. But that was the inconsistency. That's what fought. But I played 30, 35 weeks a year. That's why, to me, I only won 5 times as opposed to 10 times.
Right.
I got tough on myself that I didn't maybe learn from those situations and how to overcome that. Like I said, I wish I knew then.
Learn that on a driving range?
No.
So as we get through this, to build the junior golfer or to help your youngster become a great college golfer or even maybe become you, a 5-time winner on the PGA Tour, we know we need proximity. Mm. All right. Now, when we get to the golf course, we know that we need to build good habits. So we understand how to do that. It's like, you know, go do your task. You're doing your task. Okay, let's reward them, right? Let's tell them they're good shots. Let's talk about their good shots. At the same time, if you start a conversation talking about the good shots, then it's easier to talk about the poor shots later.
Well, I would say that's a good point because when I did TV, and I was a marketing major, and I had a BS degree, which was appropriate. We know what that stands for. But Bachelor of Science, in case you didn't know. But anyway, I was able to, you know, my boss, Kevin Landy, not so much a boss, but the guy that did the production, and several guys that I felt like were good, would start with, here's what you did right.
Right.
And here's what you need to work on.
There you go.
That's constructive.
That's exactly
right. Beating
them down.
They get
it, right? They know how to create a good habit in you.
And I was an adult, and I think we as parents, I think, and even when you're parenting your kid, we have to be aware of that.
Sure.
Whether it's junior golf or just life in general.
Because the boredom and the proximity and creating the habit, that's going to be pretty easy to do. Where you're going to spend the vast majority of your time and where really good parents and really good coaches show up is when that athlete needs to take a situation that is undesirably and try to switch it into something that is desirable. Mm-hmm. That's where you're going to show up. That's where all the greats show up. So as long as it's easy and everybody's having a great time and everybody's getting a trophy, well then, okay, like you aren't going to find great coaches or great parents there. No. On the other end of the stick, just because society might say it should be that easy, that doesn't mean that it's going to go, you're going to transition from everybody winning trophies to everybody winning trophies at a high level. There is going to be a lot of gray area there. And that gray area is going to be taking situations, such as the length of the golf course for the junior golfer, taking situations such as you're not very good out of the bunkers, let's go practice that. Taking situations where the kid is four over par through nine holes and helping them turn that into a desirable situation. That's what Tom Kite was able to do at Pebble Beach that you weren't. He was able to take that situation and somehow turn it into desirable.
Well, Jack Nicklaus would say he knew he had, 70% of the field beat when he walked down. He knew it was difficult. They'd already beat themselves. And I think one of my teammates, or from the Ryder Cup, Chip Beck, approached every day like that. Isn't this awesome? You got to love it. You got to love it. And I'm going like, you got to love what? Getting your face kicked in? Because no, getting your face kicked in, we're still only two down. Something right. That's what's Chip, but he found the good out of it. And it was difficult, but I struggled with that. I really did. And I wish, like I said,
I think you struggled with it and you were an elite performer. You struggled with it and you were an elite athlete. So if you think you struggled with it, what do you think the common person did?
Well, they really struggled with it.
So as we package these three together, here's the take home point. The kid's going to get bored. They need to be close to the golf course. When they get to the golf course, it is the PGA professional or the coach or the parent. 9 times out of 10, it's going to be the parent. Their job to create a desirably difficult situation. It is going to go haywire. It's going to go haywire.
Yeah.
When it goes haywire, remember that your job at that moment is to not react. It is to say, okay, listen, what is in front of you right now that you can control? How can we make this more desirable for you? Do we need to shorten the course? Mm-hmm. Do we just need to drive up to 10 yards off the fairway so you can chip it up there and make your birdie and get back to even that way? What are they going to do at the tournament? When you're at a golf tournament, do you think you'll be three over again at a tournament? Of course. Mm-hmm. So what can you do right now to make that better? And that's where that area starts. I give lots of playing lessons. And everybody's trying to hit the green, but nobody does. So I'll go give a golf lesson, and on number one, they'll be 150 yards from the pin for their birdie attempt. In other words, they'll drive it in the trees and have to chip it out. Number two, they'll be 40 yards from the pin for their birdie attempt. So they'll miss the green by 40 yards. Number three tee, I'll say, what are you trying to do? And they'll say, I'm trying to hit the green. And I'm like, why? It's obviously way too difficult for you to try to do that. So why not give yourself a bigger target out there, a bigger expectation? Mm-hmm. Now, in your world, elite players, you're going to run into the same situation. So you are a PGA Tour player. You're very close to the if you're a PGA Tour player, you're very close to playing the PGA Tour. When you're on that PGA Tour, you're going to have a million different types of personalities, combinations of personalities, athleticism, skills. You're going to have people that bunt it out there and make birdies, great with their short game. You're going to have people that you could not hit it with in two lifetimes. Yes or no?
Yeah.
And so you, as an elite performer, you have to have some way of taking and playing against these long hitters or maybe these very slow players that get it up and down from everywhere, and you have to be able to make it desirably difficult to play with them.
That's a big challenge.
It is a big challenge.
How do you know? That's the biggest challenge, I think, for if you're saying it, like you're saying, if you're having it at the PGA Tour level, adults are having it. What are the kids going through?
Yeah,
I mean it's rough. That's our job to kind of be aware of those things. And I think you brought some fascinating points.
Yeah, and you can't learn any of this on the driving range. That's the reason that this book is written. The driving range is not the place that you learn to handle adversity.
No, I mean,
we have to get on the golf course because the big gray area, right, the big area that separates performance is not how fast they swing the golf club. It's not how far the 7-iron goes. It is how do they react when it's really good and how do they react when it's really bad? Because everybody reacts about the same when it's what they expect.
Right.
But when you play tournament golf and you're trying to help your youngster play tournament golf, you have to prepare them for when it's really bad and for when it's really good.
Yeah.
Because that's when they're going to win and lose golf tournaments.
Yeah, and they're going to learn from those.
So, yeah, as we close it up, I'm going to let you do the closeout, but it's packaged, mm-hmm. right? So we have a high school player. We have a junior golfer. We understand, you know, how somebody gets into the game. We have this idea of when my kid gets bored, how close I am to the sport or to the tournament or to the golf course or whatever it is to the, what they love, the mountain, so to speak. So you have this boredom, you have this proximity. We understand a little bit more about creating habits as far as cue, routine, reward. Now, this third podcast is all about desirable difficulties. And so there needs to be some planning. There needs to be some ideas on the distance we're trying to set up for the kids when they're at home playing golf, for how they practice. It needs to be hard, mm-hmm. but it needs to be desirable. And when they are so fired up because they're six under par, it's like, cool. How do you get them to go, okay, what's in front of you? Mm-hmm. How do you, let's keep, I know this is really, really fun, but how do you keep this going? And then when it falls apart, it's like, cool, what's in front of you? How do we keep this going? We shouldn't come home every day from the golf course extremely happy or extremely sad. We should come home from the golf course every day having learned something.
Absolutely. Those fascinating points, and that's just part of the book. There's a lot more information, and that's just very small. It's just a few chapters out of that. And we appreciate you taking over my role, BJ. You did a pretty good job for a guy.
Thank you.
I mean,
thank
way
you.
Better host than me, but Only One Shot, the book is available at Amazon, and we've got plenty more podcasts, so we look forward to you listening to us down the road, and we're going to let Steve Azar take us home with The Coach.
What were you thinking on that play? Take a lap, and when you come back, maybe you'll do things my way. Let me tell you why, don't let things slide. If you can live through me, you can get through life. Around here, what I say goes. Out here, what I say goes. 'Cause I